So welcome to the Sci-Fi Show, where we talk science and philosophy with two of the world's leading atheist thinkers, Alex Malpass and Dan Linford. How are you doing, guys?
Good. Thanks.
Doing well.
Cool, cool. Right, so today we're going to have a bit of fun because we're going to review The Argument for God by the Christian apologist Frank Turek, who is very popular but deeply confused. Alex, tell us a little bit about Frank Turek, actually.
Okay, so if you're fortunate enough not to know who Frank Turek is already, I mean, I tried playing a bit of it to my wife earlier, and she just told me to turn it off after about 5 minutes. He is a very slick American apologist, so Christian apologist, radio show host, has this radio show called Cross-Examined, I think it's called. He has a book that he's, I guess, well known for, which is trollingly called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, which is obviously maximum ponage there. And you know, he's a very engaging, if far too shouty, public speaker. I mean, Americans shout about everything, don't they? But I guess that's a style that goes down well there. But yeah, he's a very engaging speaker. And in a way, he's a good orator. He's a communicator of ideas, which we've got to say he does well. You know, he's a good public speaker. But as he pointed out, he's deeply confused, and almost everything he says is wrong. So it was actually my idea, so I apologize in advance to you both and to anyone watching that we have to do this content, but I thought it might be fun.
Yeah, I think it will be. So the argument that we're going to review, it's like a version of the Kalam cosmological argument, which argues from the beginning of the universe to God. But, you know, we are going to be covering some different material, if you've seen our other videos on the Kalam cosmological argument. And we're going to start with a clip. Oh, before I should say, if you want to play this as a drinking game, every time Frank Turek says something wrong, you can drink. But be warned, you are going to get absolutely sloshed. So we're going to start with a clip about infinity. Daniel, why don't you just tell us a little bit, like cue this clip up for us. What's going on in this?
Yeah. So, you know, one reason you might think that the universe has a beginning is if you think that time has to be finite to the past. If there's only finite time into the past, then the universe couldn't have been around for an infinite time. It has to have only been around for finite time. So that's what he's going to be arguing for in this clip.
All right, let's cue it up. Here we go.
What is the definition of an infinite? Something that has no end, right? Well, here we are today. We're at the end. So can this line be infinite? No, because an infinite has no end, right? It can't be infinite. And can you add anything to an infinite? No, by definition, an infinite, whatever it is the sum of all possible numbers. But tomorrow, when tomorrow comes, we're going to add another day. And the day after that, we'll add another day. And the day after that, we'll add another day. You get the idea. So this timeline, no matter how far back it goes, can't be infinite. It had to have a beginning.
Alex, why don't we start with you? Anything wrong there, or is that all okay?
So he starts off by saying the definition of an infinite is, and then there's some kind of pantomime, tries to get the audience to finish the sentence. Now, I don't know why he thought they would know that that's what he meant, was going to say, that the definition of infinite is something that doesn't have an end. Because is that common usage? Maybe it is, but anyway, it's not the definition of an infinite. You know, if you try, you know, walking on the Earth in a straight line, you'll never come to an end, right? But the diameter of the Earth isn't infinite. Right, there's loads of obvious counterexamples to this sort of stupid simpleton definition of what it means for to be an infinite. So that was wrong. He also said you can't add anything.
Alex, what is the definition of an infinite?
Well, there are different types of infinite, right? There's not just one definition. It's another kind of mistake that people who don't know what they're talking about with this sort of thing will make. They'll assume there's just one concept of infinity. Actually, there's infinitely many, annoyingly. But basically, the key idea is just to think that it's a number that's greater than any finite number. Right? That's what they all share in common with each other. And the first kind of rung on the infinite ladder is just the number of all of the infinite numbers. Right? How many infinite numbers are there? The answer to that question is infinity. It's the first type of infinity. So the definition of that is just the cardinality of the natural numbers is what the first rung of infinity is.
Now we've lost Dan, so we'll have to just keep going without, and hopefully he'll come back in. But let's press on.
But of course, you know, he says you can't add anything to infinity, which is just colossally ignorant as well, because there are also various systems of transfinite arithmetic. And although, you know, Craig makes a big deal complaining that most of them don't have a well-defined subtraction or inverse arithmetical functions, they all have addition in. They all definitely have addition in, right? So in straightforward Cantorian transfinite arithmetic, you've got some infinite number, you add any finite number to it, the answer is it's the infinite number you started with. That's the rule of addition for transfinite arithmetic. So not only is it false that you can't add something to an infinite, there's straightforward mathematical systems about infinity in which they codify exactly how to do that, like rigorously. So he's completely wrong about that.
So, okay. So what about this stuff like we can't get to today? Like, what's that all about?
Well, so sometimes you hear this argument about like traversing the infinite, right? Where people will say it couldn't be that the past, there's infinitely many, say, past days prior to today, because if there were, we wouldn't have got to today yet. We'd still be only be, you know, some distance along that infinite path to today. But we are at today, so they couldn't have been. It just seems to me the worst of all of the various arguments for why the past might be finite. I just can't see what the inference is even supposed to be in this. I mean, if there was infinite amount of time, you know, just suppose that there's an infinite amount of time prior to today. Like, what's the contradiction? I mean, you're just saying it would have taken an infinite amount of time for today to arrive is just restating that premise. Like, that's what we're supposed to imagine. And then we're supposed to be given some kind of reason to think that that's not the case. And it's simply just saying that it would have taken an infinite amount of time to get here. It just seems to me the way of describing the thing that we're supposed to be showing.
People sometimes have in mind is this idea that you start at a point infinitely far in the past, then you're unable to get to the present. Now, first of all, I don't think that idea is even right. But supposing that that is to say, if you did start from a point infinitely far in the past, I don't think it's true that you couldn't get to the present. That's something that perhaps people disagree with me on. But even so, people who say that the past is infinite are not saying that there's a point infinitely far in the past that you need to start at to get to the present. Instead, they're saying there's no point in the past at which you start. But every point that there is in the past, they might say, is only finitely far in the past, right? So if the past is infinitely long, it doesn't require there to be any points infinitely far in the past. And if every point in the past is only finitely far from us, then it only takes finite time to get to the present.
Yeah, so I think what they imagine is there's a starting point infinitely long ago. You start tomorrow's one, the next day's two, and you're never going to go finished. I'm at infinity, so you can't get to today. I mean, I think that's the intuition. And the intuition is just wrong, because if the past is infinite, there is no starting point. That's
On this way of thinking about it, the past is more like the negative numbers, that like today is zero, yesterday it's minus one, the day before that's minus two, etc. And then you can see, if you think about it like that, there's no first or, you know, minus number. It just goes off forever. And that's the model that, you know, the challenging model that you could presuppose, about the, you know, what might an infinite past be like. You know, you don't have to think, oh, there's some point infinitely far away. Maybe each previous event or day or whatever is numbered by a negative number, and you know, I just can't really see what the issue is supposed to be there.
Yeah, right. The other thing to be pointed out here is that, so Turek wants to say that an infinite is something that has no end, but one thing you might now, that's a naive conception of the infinite, as has already been pointed out, but you might have another naive conception of it that's very close by to Turek's, one according to which the infinite is that which has no boundaries. Right? That's the conception that Spinoza had. And if you do have that conception of the infinite, well, then you get to a conclusion that's completely contrary to the one that Turek wants to get to, because you get to the conclusion that God and the universe are the same thing. Hmm. And you get to this pantheistic conclusion instead of a theistic conclusion. If you say that the infinite is something that has no boundaries.
Right. All right. So let's move on to this thing he calls the surge argument, which is sort of an acronym about why he thinks there's scientific evidence for a beginning to the universe.
What is the evidence that's having these scientists and virtually all scientists saying the universe had a beginning?
All right, I'm going to say drink there if you're playing the drinking game. I've interviewed like loads of early universe cosmologists, and almost none of them think the universe had a beginning. This is probably what they did think, you know, in the 1980s or something. But today, cosmologists don't think that. They think the Big Bang was just an evolution from a hot, dense state, leaving open the question whether it was a beginning or not. All right, but let's move on.
Well, here's the scientific evidence, and I have it in an acronym, SURGE, S-U-R-G-E. This will help you remember. Start with the second law. And the second law of thermodynamics says that the universe is running down. It's running out of usable energy. As time goes on, the amount of hydrogen atoms in that sun are burning up. Ultimately, that sun is going to burn out, and we're all going to go to heat death. Don't worry, apparently it's several billion or million years from now. Think of the universe as a dying flashlight. Well, suppose I had turned the flashlight on an infinitely long time ago, if you could. Would there be any light coming out of it today? No, it would have used up all its energy. Well, think about the universe as having batteries, like a flashlight. If you turned the universe on an infinitely long time ago, there'd be no energy left. The sun would be dead. We wouldn't have any heat. We wouldn't have any energy right now. But since the sun is still burning, that would mean that the universe had a beginning.
I love the fact that he doesn't know whether the sun's going to die in like a few million years or a few billion. He's so confident about everything, but like that's such a basic high school fact.
Well, you know, this argument is very old. In fact, this argument from the second law of thermodynamics or beginning of the universe predates Big Bang cosmology. There's a book by Helga Krag called Entropic Creation, in which Krag is this important historian of cosmology. And in that book, he documents how there was a group of German theologians towards the latter half of the 19th century who used what was then known about thermodynamics to try to argue for a beginning of the universe. So I think one thing that listeners or watchers should keep in mind is, so first of all, kind of cautionary note. So sometimes religious apologists think that the second law of thermodynamics is this kind of inviolable law of physics, that it couldn't have any possible violations. That's not true. So the second law of thermodynamics is a statistical feature of our world. If you have a system at thermodynamic equilibrium and you wait around long enough, you will see violations of the second law that are as large as you'd like. And so if you have infinite time, you will see an infinite number of violations of the second law that are as large as you could possibly want them to be. Now, it turns out that there's various reasons why a kind of fluctuation from equilibrium is a bad account for the initial entropy of our universe. Nonetheless, there are a variety of different ways of explaining the fact that when we look back through time, we see this entropy gradient. We see that if you go back in time, the entropy of the whole universe seems to be getting smaller and smaller. So for instance, it could be that our universe was born out of a black hole in another universe. In that case, the degrees of freedom that are, in other words, the things that are visible to the subsequent universe, that is to our universe, would be just the things that fall into the black hole. And that would give it the appearance of having this initial low entropy state. It could be that there's some kind of dynamical process that decreases the entropy in a previous universe and gives rise to our universe. It could be that there's no, there is just no equilibrium state of our universe. So the entropy can just keep on increasing forever. But if you pick at any point in time, the entropy at that time is going to be lower than the entropy at subsequent times. It's currently not known why the early universe had such a low entropy, but that's something that physicists are currently working on resolving, and it's something for which we have multiple different contending models.
Yeah, and if you watch our video series on Before the Big Bang, you'll see lots and lots of different ideas. We don't know which one's right, if any. Maybe the actual idea is something else. But certainly physicists aren't going, we've got no way to explain this. There's plenty of ways to explain this. So,
and by the way, there's something very peculiar about the idea that God would pick out a low entropy state. So you could say this, maybe God is like motivated by creating a universe that is well-crafted for the existence of sentient agents like ourselves. You need some low entropy for a low value of, you need some low entropy for the existence of sentient agents like ourselves. But it turns out that the entropy of our universe is vastly, vastly lower by a huge number of orders of magnitude than what you would expect if you had a being that was solely motivated by the creation of beings like ourselves. What you'd have to say is that, you know, whatever motivated God apparently wasn't the creation of us. But then you'd have this big mystery as to like why that would be true, or why God would be motivated in that way. And so you'd have the theistic hypothesis would be fine-tuned in a way that many theists think that naturalistic cosmological models are fine-tuned.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people quite like Roger Penrose, and I've sat and chatted with him about this, because he's always saying that, oh, it's fine-tuned to like 10 to the 10 to the 120. But he's not saying it's fine-tuned for life. Right, he's definitely not fine-tuned for life. He's the absolute opposite of that, because it could be enormously higher and life would still be here.
Right,
and so fact, this was absolutely not that. They just don't understand his argument.
This was his original point, right? So Penrose didn't think that he was arguing against theists, because he doesn't really think about theists very much. But in his book, Road to Reality, and in some of the papers where he's discussed this issue, what he has in mind are people who want to argue for a multiverse from an anthropic principle. So an anthropic principle says that, you know, where you find yourself in the multiverse just depends upon the fact that you have to find yourself in a place in the multiverse that allows for your existence. So you find yourself in the most probable place. You know, you're most likely to find yourself in the most probable place that would allow for your existence. Penrose's response is to say, the universe that we find is not the one that's the most probable one that would allow for your existence. Theists, when they're presenting a solution that is to the fine-tuning problem, are reasoning in a way that's analogous to anthropic reasoning. That is, they're motivated by the idea that God would create a universe that would allow for the existence, for our existence. And so the universe that you would expect is the one that's most probable given this requirement that we have to exist there.
But I've spoken to Penrose about this, and the way he's made it to me was that multiverse can solve anthropic fine-tuning, like these fine-tuning issues, but not for the entropy, right? Other things like the mass of the electron or whatever,
right?
The multiverse can solve those, but the issue of entropy has to have a different solution. And that's basically right.
Penrose has an alternative cosmological model to the inflationary multiverse. And part of his argument for that model has to do with his arguments against anthropic fine-tuning. So he's fine with there being an inflationary solution to the other problems. But when it comes to anthropic fine-tuning of the entropy, he thinks that that problem can't be solved. So just as that's a problem for the multiverse, it's equally a problem for the theist.
Right. And just before we move on, this issue about the batteries. Yeah, Alex, go on.
Well, I just wanted to bring out how like that. So his analogy was like, you know, a flashlight with a finite amount of energy in is going to run out after a finite amount of time or whatever. That's basically his point. And he thinks the universe is like analogous to this flashlight. And because it's still on, that means that its history is only finite or something. But it's interesting to point out that what we were talking about in the previous section about the, you know, think about the model of the infinite past where it's not presupposing that there's some point that's infinitely far into the past, but just that there's no beginning, right? It just keeps going ever further back, but that every point is finitely far away from the present, right? If that's what we're talking about, then at what point was the flashlight switched on this? Like, what am I supposed to be, like, seriously? I mean, because it's okay if you say, well, if the model was that there's some first point, but it's infinitely far away, well, that's when the flashlight was switched on. But for him, what is he going to say, that it's always been switched on? I mean, I just don't understand suppose a flashlight's always been on, but also that it's only got a finite amount of energy and it will run out of that energy in a finite amount of time. That's true that those three things are contradictory, that you can't have all three of those things. But like,
yeah.
I don't see that anything really follows from that, right? I mean, suppose, you know, if you change one of those assumptions, suppose the flashlight starts off, but at every point in the past, it's got a finite amount of energy And at the point earlier than that, it's got like some increment more, right? So it's always just going greater and greater energy as you go back. Well, that doesn't follow that it would be off today, right? Nothing follows from the fact that it's on about how far back into the past it goes, right? It could go infinitely far back, or it could go back to yesterday, and that would be it. So the analogy, it seems to me, only works if you presuppose that time does have a beginning and it's infinitely far into the past. It doesn't actually work on a more nuanced hypothesis that we brought up in the first section. So,
also, yeah, what about the possibility that the batteries could have infinite energy? Like, what's wrong with that?
Well, actually, in the book, he says that he makes this slide. Actually, I wanted to pick your brains about this because it seemed to me this was egregious. But he says, you know, the first law of thermodynamics says that energy is conserved. Is that right? And then he says, i.e., that it's finite. And I was thinking, I don't know that that's the same, right? So then he basically tries to say, well, the first law says that every battery must be finite. And the second law says that every battery runs out after a certain amount of time. It doesn't say that, you know, the first law of thermodynamics doesn't say that every battery is finite. At least, does it? That's not how I understood it.
Well, my understanding is the energy of the universe, like you can define conservation of energy like locally, like on this planet, if you go out to far, far distance. When you get to a distance where you actually feel the expansion of the universe, it's very hard. You can't really define the energy of the universe.
That's right.
So it's just not right to say the conservation of energy even applies there.
Yeah, so the technical statement, if anyone wants to look it up, is that on cosmological scales, there is no time like Killing vector. And therefore, there's no conservation of energy. The symmetric principles that you need for conservation of energy are violated in cosmology. So you don't have that principle. Now, in terms of, so I like this idea that Alex has, that if you could have a flashlight that for every moment in the past had some greater amount of energy, and you just never, you know, that's just true for as long as you want to go backwards. One of the reasons I like that argument is that I mentioned these German theologians from the latter half of the 19th century. Well, there was another theologian who disagreed with them. He thought that thermodynamics couldn't be used in the way that they thought it could be used. This guy named Caspar Eisenkrahe. And he was a guy who knew a great deal of physics. And he pointed out precisely the same argument, that you could have a monotonically decreasing function that just, you know, never really starts anywhere. It just always decreases.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to the next clip.
The U in Surge stands for the fact that the universe is expanding. And Hubble, when he looked out at these galaxies, noticed that they were all moving away from us. That the entire universe appeared to be expanding. And Hubble deduced that if they're doing this now, if the universe is doing this, yesterday the universe was here. Yesterday, the day before that, it was here, before here. And he went all the way back in time until he realized that the entire universe came from a single point of nothing.
Historically, this is nonsense. This is absolutely not what happened, right? Hubble didn't believe in the expanding universe. Right? Just read your history. I mean, he has no idea what he's talking about. Because actually at the time, that you could date when everything would be on top of each other. And it comes out to about 1.8 billion years. And already people knew that the Earth was older than that, about 4.5 billion years old. So Hubble rejected the Big Bang, right? So historically, he's just got this completely wrong.
Yeah, so there was a guy named Lemaître, who was a Belgian priest who came up with an early version of the Big Bang theory called the primordial atom theory. And he didn't think that that his primordial atom theory definitively established a beginning of all of physical reality. Right? So the Pope famously tried to argue that it did establish that. Lemaître's response was that that certainly wasn't definitive. And if you look in the first paper where Lemaître discusses this issue, part of what Lemaître says is that the atheist could consider the primordial atom the same as they consider any other point in the universe's history. So he thought it was sort of equivocal between atheism and theism, or whether there was a beginning, a creator, or whatever. Now, as far as whether an expansion establishes a beginning, it's difficult to see why anyone would even think that. The only reason to think that that's because, you know, you could imagine all kinds of things expanding. So what if they're expanding? The only reason to think that an expansion is involves something like a beginning is that in general relativity, when you extrapolate this expansion back, there are some solutions, not all solutions, to the Einstein field equations that have this feature that there's a boundary such that you can't trace the theory past that. So the theory mathematically breaks down, you get to what's called an open boundary. And those solutions of the equations, there just is nothing beyond that boundary. So that looks like a beginning, but a number of different things can be said here. One is that we have very good reason to think that general relativity is not a final theory. We have very good reason to think that in precisely the conditions of the Big Bang, that is to say, at higher energies and high densities, some other theory will need to replace general relativity. So a theory of quantum gravity, in other words, will need to replace general relativity. We know already that when you have other theories, you don't necessarily get this feature. So again, it's only in some solutions of the equations, even in general relativity, that you get this feature of a boundary. But then when you look at theories that are related to general relativity but are not general relativity, you don't necessarily find that boundary. So one of the things that was very confusing to people at first, and in the first half of the 20th century, when people were first working these details out, is that in Newtonian gravity, there's a set of equations that are very similar to the equations to describe an expanding universe. But when you don't make the assumption that the universe is isotropic and homogeneous, then you don't find anything like a Big Bang at all. In the 1970s, Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose showed that the assumptions of isotropy and homogeneity in general relativity don't necessarily allow you to avoid a boundary. But the point I want to bring out here is that we have the situation where you have virtually the same equations. We have different stories about what the underlying physics is supposed to be. One of them involves a beginning and the other does not. And now we want to know, well, what would it be like in some future physical theory that we do not have? And the answer is we have no idea.
So yeah, I mean, I think he's trading off, like, just there's like two definitions of the Big Bang. So one is that it's the beginning of time, and the other is it's like a model of the universe where it expands from a very hot dense state.
Right.
Right.
So I want to be very clear.
The second one is the one that everyone accepts. So the first one, right. I don't think anyone who works in early universe cosmology believes that. And in fact, I've got quotes from Alex Vilenkin saying nobody believes that. And not just Vilenkin, but loads of other scientists that nobody believes that, Frank.
This is quite important. Every practicing physicist thinks that physical theories have a finite domain of application. And virtually every physicist thinks, maybe perhaps every physicist thinks, that the domain of application of general relativity runs out when we go to the Big Bang. So we just don't have a theory to apply. Mm-hmm. And because we don't have a theory to apply there, we don't know what happens there.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add, we don't have a well-verified theory to apply. We have candidate theories.
We do have many candidate theories. We have no idea which of them, if any, are true.
They all say the Big Bang isn't the beginning. Now, we don't know if they're right because they haven't been empirically tested. But they are our candidate theories, and they all say the Big Bang isn't the beginning. But anyway, let's go to the next clip here.
The radiation afterglow. This is Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias. And they discovered the remnant heat from the initial Big Bang explosion.
Drink. They didn't. That's not true, right? Now, they won the Nobel Prize for discovering it, but that was like in the 70s. Nowadays, we know that Andrew McKellar actually discovered the radiation afterglow, and he did it in 1940, way before Penzias and Wilson. And anyone that's like up to date with like history of cosmology knows this. But of course, Frank Turek isn't. So he doesn't know this. Anyway, let's move on.
This is literally the smoking gun to the Big Bang. One agnostic astronomer by the name of Robert Jastrow said that when this discovery was made, this put the nail in the coffin of the last doubting Thomas who thought the universe was eternal. Because scientists 100 years ago thought the universe was eternal. It didn't have a beginning. But after they started making these discoveries by 1965, they said, look, This theory, which was called the steady state theory, that the universe was eternal, this theory can no longer be believed. After we've discovered the smoking gun to the Big Bang, the last doubting Thomas has been convinced that the universe isn't eternal. It actually had a beginning.
Okay, Dan, before we come to you, because I know you've been reading up on Jastrow, I just want to say that what the CMB showed was that the model of an eternal universe developed by Bondi, Gold, and Hoyle was wrong. Okay, actually, it was developed by Einstein first. People didn't know this till more recently, but Einstein had a version of it before them. So yeah, they showed their version of an eternal universe is wrong. There's lots of other versions of an eternal universe that are completely untouched. In fact, the people that predicted the CMB were Gamow and his team and Dickey, right? Dickey and Gamow both thought the universe contracted and then expanded. So both in that model, right, which can be eternal, you would see the CMB, right? So it shows you nothing about whether the universe had a beginning. But Dan, I know you've been reading up on Jastrow, so tell us about it.
Comes in on that, because I just have a really small question before, because I know Dan's going to tell us a load of interesting stuff then, but I'll forget what my question was if I don't say it now. It's just, is it true, is this the right way to think about it, that there was this steady state theory, which basically, okay, said that the universe was eternal, but it's key thing that it said was that everything's been a steady state. It's been like this for the whole of eternity, right? It's not just that it's infinitely old or something, but it fundamentally hasn't changed very much. Yeah. And that's the thing that's conclusively refuted by the afterglow of the Big Bang or whatever, right? Because that shows you that at some point in the past, it must have been very different than it currently is.
Yeah.
And that's what conclusively brought the way the theory or whatever.
Yeah.
Frank is focusing in on, well, it must have been that they conclusively proved that time has a beginning, a finite point in a go, right? And that's just not what the... it's just strange to me to think that anyone thought that, you know, this measurement of the background radiation has that kind of metaphysical consequence. Like, it's a really weird jump, like a non-scientific jump to go beyond what the evidence shows you. But I don't know, does that seem right?
I think that's
right. So the steady state, what steady state cosmology was the view that the universe is expanding, so they accepted the expansion, but they said that in the space between galaxies, new protons are coming into existence. And so as the galaxies are moving further apart, new galaxies come into existence between them in such a way that the density of the universe is maintained at a fixed value over time. What the CMB showed was that the universe must have been, the universe in the largest observable scales must have been hotter and denser in the past. Of course, we don't know what was beyond the regions that we can observe. We also don't know if there was something that happened before that hot, dense period in the universe's history. So turning to Jastrow, this.
Oh, hang on. Before you do, Dan, I want to make one more point, which people don't realize is that modern contemporary cosmology and George Smoot, who. Frank Turek's going to quote later, says inflationary cosmology is the standard model of cosmology, right? Now, there are a few people that dispute that, but that's not going to help Turek. But anyway, the inflationary model, right, it's basically is the steady state, I would argue, because it's just at a different scale. So Dan mentioned that in the steady state, these protons are coming into existence, and they come into existence from this thing that Hoyle came up with called the creation field. Right. And so new galaxies effectively emerge from this creation field, and it all is at the very largest scales. It's all the same. Right. Now, in inflationary cosmology, you get bubble universes percolating out of an inflating space, an inflaton field. So the steady state, if you just replace the creation field with an inflaton field, right, and then you replace the galaxies with pocket universes, at the largest scales, it's basically the same. And Alan Guth said this. He said it in his book, that the inflationary universe will strongly resemble the steady state. So people keep talking about the death of the steady state, and it's true that the version of the steady state proposed by Hoyle and his colleagues is refuted, but other versions of the steady state, like, you know, inflationary cosmology, are certainly not refuted. And in fact, Smoot thinks it's like standard cosmology. Anyway, but Dan, go on, tell us about Jastrow. Yeah,
right. So this is Jastrow's book, God and the Astronomers. It's a fascinating book. I don't know who the target audience for this book was. I suspect that it was children. The type is very large. It's a very short book. It's lots of pictures. I also think this was Turek's primary source for information on cosmology. If you read I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be a Christian, he cribs things directly from this.
Dan, it's, I haven't got enough faith.
Right, I don't have faith to be
an atheist. That's our book. Sorry. Where are you from?
Yeah. So anyway, he just consistently, both in the clips we're watching and in that book, seems to crib things from this book by Jastrow. And that seems to be something you'll find more generally. If you just do like a Google search of Robert Jastrow and Christianity or something, you'll find a lot of people who take various quotes from Jastrow. Now, Jastrow himself was someone whose political ideology I would not agree with. He was a climate change denialist. For instance, he worked for a conservative think tank called the George C. Marshall Foundation. However, when it came to cosmology, his views about cosmology were actually quite similar to the ones that I defended in my dissertation. So the argument that Jastrow actually gives is that when you trace a chain of causation backwards through time, so you look at how present events are caused by events before that and events before that, you eventually come to a place where we can no longer scientifically trace the chain of causation. He thinks that whatever it was that happened before the Big Bang, if anything did, is not epistemically available to us because all of the evidence would have been destroyed by the Big Bang. Now, I don't agree with the idea that we need to think about physics in terms of causation. The way that I would put this is that when you trace phenomena backwards through time using the laws of physics, you eventually come to a point where our knowledge of the laws of physics runs out. But otherwise, I think this is basically the right way to look at the situation. Now, what he does make a number of provocative claims that puts him in touch with theologians in various respects. But what he says there, if you look at it carefully, is that just as theologians have regarded God's creation of the universe to be a great, profound mystery, when we turn back the clock and look at the Big Bang, we find a great, profound mystery. But he's not saying, and as far as I can tell, has never said, that this should indicate to us that God exists. Now, there are some places where he says that this means that there was a supernatural cause of the universe. That might sound like he's talking about God, but actually, I think what he's saying is he's using the supernatural as a kind of euphemism as for anything that goes beyond our empirical or scientific knowledge of the world. So he thinks that our scientific or empirical knowledge runs out at the Big Bang, and that because it runs out there, it's something like the intrusion of the supernatural. In other words, it's the intrusion of something we don't understand. But that's a very far cry from saying that it was God's intervention into the world or something. The other thing that's happened is that, so in 1981, there was this important trial in Arkansas, McLean v. Arkansas. The Arkansas school board wanted to, or maybe it was a school board in some local part of Arkansas. But anyway, there was a school board that wanted to teach creationism in science classrooms. And the following year, so, you know, while all this turmoil is going on in the press about evolution and creationism and Big Bang versus God and all this stuff, and while this is all on people's minds, a magazine called Christianity Today did an interview with Jastrow. And there, Jastrow tries to make, I think, a number of remarks where he tries to be sort of conciliatory towards religious people. He makes it very clear in the article that he is not a creationist and doesn't think that there's any stock that we should put in creationism. But in that article, in that interview, he thinks that, he says that while people are wrong to think that teaching evolution involves teaching something like godless atheism, at the same time, he understands maybe some of the concerns that they have, that that there are things that are being taught in science classrooms that might be threatening to a kind of conservative conception of faith. Jastrow, though, thought that science and religion properly understood are two independent things. So there was a much later, there was a panel discussion on public access television in the United States, in which Jastrow took part. And at the end of that conversation, Jastrow says explicitly that he thinks that religion and science properly understood are two completely independent things. Something like, so Stephen, there was a paleontologist named Stephen Jay Gould. He had this idea about non-overlapping magisteria, that science and religion are these two independent ways of understanding the world that should not impact one another. And I think Jastrow had precisely the same sort of view. And so his conciliatory remarks should be understood in that context.
But I also think there's another context, which is that he's a right-wing conservative in America. So even if he is a believer or not a believer, he knows his audience. So of course he's going to say things friendly to his audience, right? Jordan Peterson does the same thing. He knows his audience are all Christians. But if you ask him, does he believe in God? He kind of always fudges it, right? and so, yeah, no, surprising he says, you know, sympathetic stuff to religion. He knows his audience. Why should we care what he says?
I think that what bothers me about, like, going through all this material over the last few days is that while Jastrow himself is quite explicit that he doesn't think cosmology should lead us to think that God exists, and in fact is very aware of things like the hourglass cosmology that we discussed in our last episode and discusses that kind of model explicitly in his book, he's often quoted out of context, or people take some of these more conciliatory remarks that he sometimes made, and then they quote that ad nauseum, and people tend not to go back and look at what he actually wrote.
It's a really complex, difficult book. You can't really.
It's a little bit of 100 pages, most of which are pictures. 100
times every to read 100 pages.
It took me an afternoon to read the entire book.
A whole afternoon. Come on. That's unreasonable. All right, let's go to the next clip.
Now, scientists thought that if the universe did have a beginning, that there should be some temperature variations in what's called the radiation afterglow. 1992, they had enough measurements to draw a conclusion. And this is the G, called the Great Galaxy Seeds, in our evidence here. In fact, the man who really headed the expedition was a man by the name of George Smoot. Here he is. And he taught at UCal Berkeley. And he wrote a book called Wrinkles in Time. And Stephen Hawking, look at his endorsement right on the cover of the book. He said, the scientific discovery of the century, if not all time.
What he failed to mention there was that Smoot was one of the principal investigators on that satellite. One of the others was John Mather. And John Mather was asked on the Nobel Prize website what happened before the Big Bang. And he didn't say anything consistent with Turek, because Turek's answer would be nothing. Nothing happened before the Big Bang. What Mather says was, well, we don't know, but maybe we can find out in the future. So completely inconsistent. The other thing, of course, is that Smoot, as I said, thinks that inflationary cosmology is standard cosmology. If inflation is true, then if there's a beginning, we're not going to see it, because inflation, at least in standard cosmology, would erase any sign of a beginning. So all this observational stuff he's mentioning is just utterly irrelevant, because
I actually don't know what it is that he's bringing up. What is the Great Galaxy Seed? I've listened to him say this so many times. It always goes in one ear and out. What is he talking about?
He's basically talking about temperature fluctuations in the CMB. Like, if you look at the CMB, it's all the same temperature. If you get to a certain scale, it's same temperature. Next scale, same temperature. Once you get to about one part in 100,000, suddenly you see small variations. And from these small variations, they had to be there. If they weren't there, galaxies wouldn't form. So they had to be there. And that's what they were hoping to see with that experiment. And then they saw it. And they were like, brilliant. That's the discovery of the century. You know, so that's what the seeds are.
Why is that the discovery of the century, if not all time?
Because it basically, well, of course, Hawking was an early universe cosmologist. And in those days, people thought early universe cosmology was just fantasy. There was no data. Finally, we've got data. Like, suddenly this is like a picture of the, you know, earliest light that we can see. And now we turn this very speculative science into like a concrete science with real data. So that's why Hawking hyped it up as the, you know, this greatest discovery.
Okay, and like imagine you're explaining it to a child, which is what it's like talking to me about science. But why does Turek think that that means that the universe had a beginning?
I guess because if it was wrong, if we never saw those seeds, then the Big Bang Theory would be wrong, right?
Why?
So we have to see those seeds.
Oh, because then there wouldn't have been galaxies.
Yeah, the galaxies wouldn't have formed.
Right. So something about our understanding would have had to have been wrong because so in order for galaxies to form, you need to have matter that gets like clumped together by gravity, and the only way for that formation to begin is if you have these like these local regions that are denser than others, and you know that will start this like runaway effect where stuff starts like coming in and clumping up. If you didn't find that, that would mean that our understanding of what the CMB even was to begin with would have been wrong.
Wouldn't it mean that maybe there's another way galaxies can form? Are we rock solid on the theory of how galaxies can form?
There are suggestions for how you generate these fluctuations, right? So, in fact, the standard suggestion is that they come from inflation, variations in the early universe. They're stretched by inflation. But there are other models, like their thermal fluctuations. So, for example, there's a model inspired from string theory called string gas cosmology. And that assumes actually there's thermal fluctuations in
but that still gets you the fluctuations in the CMB. Alex is asking, suppose we're in another world, we don't see fluctuations in the CMB at any observable scale. Then how would we explain that? Well, I mean, that would be a big problem because it would mean that our understanding of what the CMB is that it's this radiation that was left over when the gas in the early universe became thin enough to release radiation. Like at the very early universe, when the gas is denser than that, any bit of a plasma or you know, charged gas that releases electromagnetic radiation is going to be almost right away absorbed by some other bit of gas. So only when you get to something that's thin enough that that radiation can go off to infinity that we can suddenly begin that radiation starts being emitted that we can observe. Now, if we didn't find those kinds of fluctuations, that would mean that our picture of what all those different pieces are would have to be wrong. It would have to either be wrong that galaxies were formed from these initial clumps in that plasma, or it would have to be wrong that the radiation is released when that plasma got thin enough, or it would have to, you know, so some part of the picture would have to be wrong.
Yeah, something would be different, but it's like he's saying, you know, it's not A and B and C, therefore it must be not A. Right, and it's like, well, hold on, it could have been, you know, not A or not B or not C, etc., right?
I think the important piece here is that those density fluctuations in the CMB that line up with the distribution of galaxies, for instance, is further confirmation of the Big Bang model. And so since he thinks the Big Bang is the beginning, he then takes it to be further evidence of a beginning. But what's important. I think what I would point out is just that, no, it's actually just further evidence that the universe on the largest observable scales was once hotter and denser in the past. But so what? That does not at all mean that there was... I mean, so, you know, creationists... I don't know if Turek is a creationist or not, but one thing that creationists are often a fan of is this idea that there was once a global flood. That idea that there was a global flood would be, if you saw it on the geological record, a kind of catastrophe such that you know, you couldn't like find things before because it would wipe out all the geological features that you could want because it would be such a violent event. Well, no creationist thinks that the global flood was the beginning of time. So the fact, you know, if you look back in time and you find some evidence of some very violent event in the past that wipes out anything that could have come before it and makes this very strong signal in either your, you know, astronomical record or in your geological record, whatever records you're looking at, it doesn't mean that there was nothing before it. All it means is that whatever there was before, if there was anything, would have been wiped out by the process that gave rise to this very violent event.
All right, let's move on to the next clip, Einstein.
The E in surge stands for Einstein. And Einstein knew that the universe had a beginning as far back as 1916. He knew this, but he didn't.
Drink. No, he didn't. He just didn't. He found it, as I understand it, Dan, you correct me if I'm wrong, that the solutions to his equations were unstable. So the universe could be expanding or contracting. It says nothing about whether the universe had a beginning, right? He didn't think that at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's right. And you can find solutions to the Einstein field equations that don't have a beginning. Turek right. likes to pretend that an inevitable consequence of general relativity is the universe has a beginning. And that's just not a consequence at all. I can very easily write down a solution to the Einstein field equations that is beginningless.
But he didn't like it. Einstein wanted the universe to be eternal. He wanted a steady state universe. So the great Einstein decided to put a fudge factor into his equations to allow the universe to be static and eternal. Some say that the great Einstein, in order to do this, divided by zero. Now, what are you told in grammar school? You never divide by zero. You can go straight to hell for that, right? Never divide by zero. Well, the great Einstein divided by zero, and mathematicians in the 1920s were looking at his equations going, Dr. Einstein, you can't divide by zero. Then 1931, Einstein...
Dan, come on.
So this is again, straight from this book. But actually...
He gets everything from the same book.
Right. Even though it's... Turek gets it wrong, even though it's a very simple book to understand. So what Jastrow says is that Einstein made a mathematical error in working out some equations that was analogous to dividing by zero. He does not say that Einstein divided by zero. Now, one of the ironies of this is that if you take seriously the results in general relativity that do give you a beginning, right? So those models of Big Bang cosmology that have a beginning, they do involve dividing by zero. So there's a parameter, capital H, sometimes called the Hubble constant, but you get it by dividing. So there's a thing called the scale factor, which tells you something like the relative distance between galaxies. If you take the rate at which the scale factor changes and divide by the scale factor itself, that's just that parameter capital H. Now, when the universe has zero size at the singularity, you have that A on the bottom and it's zero. So part of the reason that we say that physics breaks down at the Big Bang is that the equations lead you to effectively divide by zero. So this situation is actually, in some sense, completely the opposite of the one that Turek thinks it is. His favorite model of the Big Bang is the one that involves effectively dividing by zero, not the one that Einstein wanted. Now, I don't know what mathematical mistake it is actually that Jastrow is referring to, because he doesn't tell you. Again, it's a very simply written book. I do know of some literature and some Einstein scholarship that talks about some worries or some confusions that Einstein had about the exact kind of differential equation that the Einstein field equations are in the very early days around 1915 or so. There was a very early cosmology paper that Einstein came out with in which he proposes the static universe model. It's not a steady state universe, that's why what Turek says, but it's a different static universe model. And in that paper, Einstein says some things that are a little bit confused about the exact kind of differential equation that he's working with. But that's not a question about dividing by zero.
All right, let's go to the next bit.
Einstein went out to California and he looked through Hubble's telescope. Einstein's looking through the telescope, he sees the expanding universe, and a point later, after he got off the telescope, he said to the news media, he said, "I now see the necessity for a beginning."
Drink. No, you cannot see the expanding universe by looking through a telescope. No. That is not
I think where
works.
He gets this. So there's like a caption beneath one of the pictures in Jastrow's book where it discusses both the trip that Einstein made to look through the telescope and Einstein coming to think that there's an expanding universe, but doesn't make the claim that like one is causally connected to the other.
Like if Fletcher knew anything about cosmology, he wouldn't make that statement, right? Because it's statistical in nature. You just don't do it.
And in fact, it's a very difficult inference to make. So if you go back and look at like Hubble's original plots, where you like plot Hubble's law, you know, what you want is like this very clean graph where you see points that lie along a line. And that's not what you find this like big hornet's nest of points. And then you have to use some sophisticated statistics to get out the information that you want out of it. Now we have much better ways of doing this kind of thing because people can observe galaxies that are much further away and a much greater number. So the plots we can make now are much cleaner. But the plots available in Hubble's time are actually very dirty.
The misquote is that Einstein did say that the observations had smashed his worldview, basically, which was a static universe. But then, whilst he was at Mount Wilson, and we know this, I'll tell you how in a sec, he actually constructed an early version of the steady state. He didn't publish it. It was only found in, like, I think, 2014 or something like that. But we know because he did it whilst he was at Mount Wilson because they found the writing paper and it was the Mount Wilson writing paper, right? So he certainly didn't have that view at all. Total nonsense. All right, let's move on.
So hold on. What year was it that he was at Mount Wilson?
I think it was 1931.
So how come in 1916 he already knew that the universe had a beginning, according to Turek, but in 1931 he looks through a telescope and he's all like, oh no, I now concede the thing I knew in 1916. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, on its own terms, so it doesn't make any sense.
Turek's account throughout, and this is where he sort of consistently argues in various different places on various different issues, is that, like, he thinks people are motivated by their bias against Christianity to reach all these conclusions. So he wants to say that, like, Einstein was somehow biased against these kinds of theistic hypotheses, and that's why he said the things he said in 1916. When, in fact, if you look at making a mistake about the kind of differential equation you're working on is a very technical issue, and it has nothing to do with, like, having some kind of bias against God.
The other thing is, in 1916, there was no evidence of a dynamic universe. So it's no surprise that when he came up with his equations, he went, oh, I better make it fit observations, which is a static universe.
That's right. And it goes deeper into that. So in the 19th century, there were already some indications they had the wrong gravitational theory. People were trying to modify Newtonian gravity in various ways. There was a guy named Seeliger who was fairly famous for his modifications of gravity. He introduced something like a cosmological constant into Newtonian gravity. So part of what Einstein is doing when he introduces the cosmological model into his own static state, static conception of the universe, is to connect his work on gravitation with pre-existing research. Right? But this history with Seeliger and so on is something that I'm sure Turek knows nothing at all about.
Right. Well, is it mentioned by Jasper? Does Jasper cover it? Because if not, no. And can I just also say, before it floats off into the distance, it makes me laugh when he says something like, it has been said by some that Einstein divided by zero. It was like, I mean, a citation needed. Who said that? What are you talking about? And obviously the answer is Jasper says that. But also, it just reminds me of Trump. It's like, a lot of people are saying, you know, a lot of people say that Einstein divided by zero. It's such a shit way of putting it. There's no detail. Like, divided what by zero? What do you mean? He has no idea what was supposed to be done. Anyway,
it's a very poor scholarship.
Okay.
The cosmological constant, the fudge factor that he put into his equations, was his greatest mistake of his professional career. Turned out that Einstein was actually right. There is a.
So this is so massively confused. So on one hand, he wants to connect this thing about dividing by zero, the cosmological constant. That's wrong. Einstein did think at some point that introducing cosmological constant wasn't the right way to go. However, he did it because it had this like relationship with Seeliger. And moreover, as Turek is about to say, the introduction of the cosmological constant was the right thing to do in some sense, because we now know that there's a cosmological constant. Moreover, early models of the Big Bang, like Lemaître's, included the cosmological constant as a thing that drove the expansion of the universe. So it's like just everything here is wrong.
It's going to get even more wrong. Just wait for this.
There is a cosmological constant, but it wasn't the value that he had. The cosmological constant is now known as dark energy or dark matter that is actually accelerating the expansion of the universe right now. We call it dark energy or dark matter, and that dark energy is fine-tuned to one part in 10 to the...
Oh, it cut off.
So,
what he actually said was it was fine-tuned to 10 to the power 160.
What? Which, where does he get that number?
There are different...
It's not even the right number. So, you know, there's a number of... So, first of all, he's confused between dark matter and dark energy. Those are not the same thing. Dark matter is something that was introduced in order to explain the motions of bodies in response to the gravitational pull of something that we can't observe. So most famously, this wasn't the first place it was postulated, but this was the most famous example, that there's what are called galactic rotation curves. These curves that tell you how fast each part of a galaxy is moving as its distance from the center. You have to introduce some additional matter to explain those galactic rotation curves. At least that's one idea about how to explain them. The dark energy, which is a thing that actually does have a relationship with the cosmological constant, is this kind of energy that's associated with space-time itself that drives the accelerated expansion of the universe. And that, you know, in models of inflation, that same parameter, that the same thing you put into the equations plays that role, but at a much higher value for the early universe. So the other thing that's worth mentioning here is that if you have, suppose that we don't know whether the cosmological constant changes with time, but suppose it was very large in the early universe. Well, then it prevents a beginning, because it prevents everything from collapsing down into a point. And so instead you have one of these hourglass cosmologies that we discussed last time. In fact, you have one of the simplest hourglass cosmologies. You have something called De Sitter space. But anyway, it's just everything he's saying here is just completely wrong.
That's right. All right, let's get to his conclusion. Could he rescue things at the conclusion, say something right? Place your bets.
By the way, this is an actual picture of Saturn from the Hubble Space Telescope. That's not a painting. That's Saturn in infrared. Here's what...
No, it isn't. Anyone that does astronomy, that's not an infrared picture. That's in the UV. But anyway, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect the conclusion.
Here's what Jastrow, the agnostic astronomer, said in an interview. He said, astronomers now found they painted themselves into a corner because they have proven by their own methods that the world began abruptly in an act of creation to which you can trace the seeds of every star, every planet, every living thing in this cosmos and on the Earth. And they have found that all this has happened as a product of forces they cannot hope to discover. That there are what I or anyone would call supernatural forces at work is now, I think, a scientifically proven fact. Why couldn't nature have created the universe? Why couldn't nature have created the universe? Anyone? There was no nature. Nature had a beginning. If the universe had a beginning, we've got two options. Either no one created something out of nothing, which is the atheistic view, or someone created something out of nothing, which is the theistic view. Now, here's my only question. Which view is more reasonable?
Alex, which view is more reasonable? Come on.
Well, this is another one of those cases where, like, the point he's trying to make ends up, it seems to me, backfiring and in the worst possible way, right? Like, if you think creating something from nothing is like the start, was like a decision tree, like either creation from nothing is problematic or it's not. Like, if it's not problematic, then, you know, some kind of atheist could just come along and say, well, maybe it was just created from nothing. Well, that's fine, right? That's just what happened. So you have to You have to start off by not taking that branch and thinking creation out of nothing is deeply problematic. There's something metaphysically impossible about that happening. But I guess if you're an atheist who thinks that the universe began at some point in the past, but that you know there's no multiverse, there's no deeper explanation or anything, it's just like these really basic models where just sort of everything comes from a singularity and that's the beginning of time or something. Maybe you're in trouble there, but like, what if you're the guy who, like we've been hypothesizing the whole way through, who just, his idea is that maybe the universe doesn't have a beginning, right? Well, how, in what sense is that person committed to any kind of creation out of nothing? Just, I don't understand what he's talking about, right? Like, there has to be a beginning for there to be creation out of nothing. If it's just beginningless, like, I don't understand, it doesn't have a point at which it begins. So, what do we mean by it being created out of nothing? On the other hand, the theist is explicitly committed to God somehow doing something that creates something out of nothing. So if it's a problem, it's a problem for that atheist who thinks the universe has a beginning, but it isn't, doesn't seem, or at least who holds one very hyper-specific model that's going on there. But if you like the idea that we were talking about before, where maybe it's beginningless, it just feels like that's much more sensible. And that view, there's no creation out of nothing at all. And so that's the more simple one, absolutely, yeah. And the way he phrases it, because like the word nothing is ambiguous between, you know, a strong or a weak reading, right? You know, there's nothing in the fridge doesn't mean that there's a void, an empty void in the fridge. It just means there's not any food or something, right? But so then, oh crap, what was I going to say about that? Damn it, I've confused myself. But anyway, hopefully I made the point clearly enough that like the atheist needn't be committed to there being any creation from nothing.
Well,
if you
think
creation
point...
from nothing's problematic, then you know we've just avoided the problem that the theist has got. Sorry,
I think the point you're going to make was that there's two different readings of the word nothing. So like one is where there's just no things, right? So to say that nothing created the universe is to say that there is nothing, that there is no X such that X was the creator of the universe. A different reading of nothing is to say that there was an X, that X is nothing, and X created the universe, which is obviously wrong. There couldn't be such a thing. So given those two readings, one of them is obviously incorrect. That's the one that he wants to attribute to the atheist. But there's a much more charitable way of reading the atheist, which is to say that the atheist could say that there are no entities such that those entities created the universe.
Yeah, that's right. So you can hear what he said as if it's reading the word nothing and the weak reading, where it's just for all X, it's not the case that X created the universe. And you could like paraphrase that by saying, nobody created the universe from nothing, right? As in, for all X, it's not the case that X created the universe from nothing. That's just all that means, right? So I guess it's an ambiguity over the word nobody or something. Like, we're not saying there's this nobody character and he created the universe out of nothing. Or on the other hand, there's this God character and he created the universe from nothing. That's like the contrast he wants you to imagine. It's so juvenile, really, when you think about it.
So what I want to say is that one of the things he's trading off is that Lawrence Krauss, who is an atheist, wrote this book called Universe from Nothing. So a lot of people think that atheists are tied to this view that the universe came from nothing. But there's lots of different models of cosmology, and lots of them don't have creation from nothing in any sense of the word nothing. So there's absolutely no reason to associate atheism with the universe from nothing. Now, having said that, there are some cosmologists, Alex Valenkin probably being the most well-known one, who suggested Stephen Hawking, of course, but there's ambiguity about Hawking's model, right, which isn't really present in the Valenkin model. And he thinks the universe did come from nothing, but how does this happen? Well, basically, he has to assign sort of a platonic existence to the laws of physics, that the laws of physics are all you need to generate the universe from nothing. Now, that's a pretty weird view. I am not saying that Valenkin is right, but I don't think it's any more weird than saying an immaterial being created the universe from nothing. If that's okay, why isn't Valenkin's view okay? It just seems, I don't see any reason to prefer the God view over Valenkin's view.
The other thing I wanted to bring up here, so at the beginning of that clip, Turek's talking again about Jastrow, and he again misunderstands what Jastrow's point is. So Jastrow has this idea in his book, it's an idea that I don't really agree with, but it's one that maybe could be defended. This idea that scientists have as an article of faith or something that they take deep trust in, that for any natural phenomena, there will always be an explanation for that phenomena, right? So when we trace back the universe, there's this expectation that we're always going to find a scientific explanation for what we find. And Jastrow thinks that when we get to the Big Bang, even though science leads us there, science has led us to a place where by its own merits, by the account of the Big Bang, whatever came before it isn't something we're going to have a scientific record of. And so it's where science runs out, and yet that conflicts with this article of faith, he calls it, that there's always going to be a scientific explanation available. Now, Turek turns around and says, and interprets Jastrow as saying not that that's where our ability to explain things runs out, but rather that we need to insert God at precisely that point, right? And that's what Jastrow is telling us effectively not to do. If it's true that we can't like have an explanation at that point, then it's equally true that we can't have a theological explanation at that point. Like I don't understand how it could possibly be that we can't have an explanation, yet we can have an explanation in terms of God. Right. Right? Those two things are in direct contradiction with one another.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, look, is there anything else you want to say in the wrap up? Otherwise, we should close things out. Anything else, guys?
Well, I look forward to seeing whether Turek watches this in response to it.
Oh, that would be lovely. Well, I'm going to bet that he won't. And I'll bet
he's welcome to come on. He's welcome to come on the show as a guest and explain.
You're welcome
to us.
Anytime, Frank. We'd be happy to have you. I'm going to put a lot of money that he's going to ignore this video. But anyway, till next time, if you like this video, please like and subscribe. If you've got any suggestions for future shows, put them in the comments. And we'll see you next time on The Sci-Fi Show.